I'm Dr. Leif Tapanilla from the Idaho Museum of Natural History, and I'm here with Peter Pruitt from Zoo Idaho, and this is The Nature of Idaho. Coming to you from the 1B, Bannock County that is, we're talking all about Idaho, its wild places and wild faces, the natural setting that makes Idaho an incredible place to live and be proud of. Our guest today is Matt Cahill. He's a program director at the Nature Conservancy. Today we're talking about the Sagebrush Sea Program. Peter, do you like yourself the Sagebrush Sea?
Yeah, I like the Sagebrush Sea.
I think it's great.
I think so too. And this will be a great topic because I think for all of us who've lived in Idaho for a while or grew up in Idaho, Wyoming, Oregon, where the Sagebrush Steppe is, we see it every day.
That's right.
And we might lose just how fascinating our Sagebrush Steppe is.
Have you ever sailed a boat through the Sagebrush Sea?
No.
Hard to do.
Yeah.
My favorite smell, maybe one of the top three, is after it rains and you're among the sage, and that smell is just so good.
But aren't you allergic to sagebrush?
I was going to say, I am also extremely allergic to sage, especially when it's flowering. And so I only do it in the spring.
Okay. Gotcha.
Yeah. But it is such a great smell.
Sage after the rain is great. And at the zoo, we have it everywhere. And so.
Right.
Yeah.
You better like it.
I do.
Them and the marmots.
Yep. Well.
One out of two ain't bad.
Yeah. Okay. We'll leave it at that.
How about some nature in the news?
Yeah. Leif, forests around the world are undergoing a major shift. We've got some new research out that shows the forest ecosystem are becoming more uniform, losing their biodiversity and growing less resilient. And what's causing this really is fast-growing trees are becoming increasingly more dominant than the slow-growing trees.
Yeah.
And with the slow-growing trees, they've got specialized traits that are, you know, facing a greater risk of decline and extinction. These slow trees thrive in a stable environment. They form the backbone of a forest ecosystem. They contribute to stability, carbon storage, and they really are resilient to change. But because of whether it's climate change, industry, logging, urbanization as we're coming in and building roads, the forests are facing significant amounts of disturbance. And it just basically is opening everything up to the fast-growing trees. They are more vulnerable to any type of change like drought, storms, pests, climate shock. And you're getting less stable forests in there. And we're also getting non-native species moving in. About 41% of our non-native species here in the United States are fast-growing trees.
Yep.
And you know, when you've got this disturbance, it just opens it up for these types of trees to take over. And it really is severely impacting our native forests.
Right. And you can imagine replenishing forests is something that people are interested in doing after a disturbance, after a fire, after logging or what have you. But I remember a recent show that we had talking about the idea that, you know, when those plantings happen, then you end up with a stand of trees that are all exactly the same age. And so you lose that even age demographic diversity as well as maybe species diversity that you would have in a more natural, unplanted
space. And a lot of these plantings are in rows. And so you're missing out on the varying tree landscape as well. So
and we're seeing this on a global, you know, this isn't just something that's happening in the boreal forest or in the temperate zone. This is happening in rainforests.
And a lot of it in the rainforest.
Right.
Yep.
Right. The world's changing. How will we adapt? Trivia question for today is dealing, of course, with the Sagebrush Sea. Our question is, in acres, how big is that Sagebrush Sea? When we come back from our break, Matt Cahill will join us and talk all about sagebrush and the wonderful landscapes that it occurs in. So stay tuned.
Get continued access to local news and all the programs you enjoy through the Listen Live link at KISU.org, or try using your web-connected Amazon or Google smart speaker with the command Play KISU.
Hey, we're back from the break. Our guest today is Matt Cahill. He's a program director at the Nature Conservancy. So first off, welcome to the Nature of Idaho.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, Matt, tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do.
Sure. Yep. Well, for a day job, as you said, I'm the program director for the Nature Conservancy on our Sagebrush Sea program. which is a collection of efforts that we lead, partner, do, support across basically all the Intermountain West, 7 different states, which I can tell you more about in a moment. But me personally, I call Bend, Oregon home. And when I'm not doing this kind of thing, talking on the internet, telling the good story about our work and our people and our partnerships, you can usually find me out with a pair of binoculars. I have a very serious birding addiction. And so that's what I spend most of my free time doing. Chasing birds, giving them names. It's a great hobby if you haven't picked it up yet.
What's
it really helps
what's
you.
Your life list up to now?
Oh, I'm just too shy of 700 in the U.S.
Wow, congratulations. That's a pretty big number.
Yeah, pushing 2,000 in the world. So,
there you go. Jeez.
Not too shabby. There are way higher accolades, but I'm doing all right.
Very good. Very good. Okay, well, the sagebrush sea. What is that for those of us who haven't heard that term before?
Yeah, which you wouldn't be faulted if you haven't. Sure. And actually, kind of funny aside, I often get feedback. Big part of my job is take a lot of feedback and find a way forward, right? That's program directing for you. And a lot of people say, sagebrush sea, I don't get it. It doesn't mean anything to me. I want something more tangible, more concrete. Well, in the same breath or same meeting, somebody else will go like, I love it. Poetry. We need more poetry in the world. I personally lean into the poetry side. It's meant to evoke so much expanse, huge horizons, endless landscapes that are really our Intermountain West. And when you're out in one of these landscapes like Western Wyoming or Southern Idaho or Northern Nevada, it feels like this rangeland and grassland environment, which is the sagebrush sea, just carries on forever, far into the distance, like you are afloat in some great wide ocean. So we use that name as an evocative, poetic way to describe our work. But in essence, we do restoration, protection, and management of grasslands and rangelands in the Intermountain West. So think Rockies to the Cascades, Canada to the Grand Canyon, all those big open landscapes in between. Basically, if it doesn't have forests on it, you're in the sagebrush sea, unless it's been turned over to potatoes or cities, which a lot of it has.
Yeah. So is the sagebrush steppe, sagebrush sea unique? Is this something that we really only find in North America?
So steppe communities are global. Yep. You know, think Mongolia or parts of Eastern Europe. These like areas of the world that are grasslands or shrublands, not a lot of rain, cold winters, harsh growing environments. That's what gives you a step. But the sagebrush step is uniquely North American. The component of our Artemisia, which is our sagebrush, along with the unique flora and fauna that goes with it, like sage grouse and pronghorn, and really the embeddedness it has amongst our various mountain ranges and western rivers, is a landscape unlike any other step system on Earth. It's wholly ours, North American. Today, it's mostly, basically entirely in the United States. There used to be some in Canada, but that has largely been converted to agriculture now. So it's an American identity, and it's the single largest biome in the U.S. if you give it its generous boundary.
Yeah, and again, if you live in Idaho, you know this landscape very well. I think it's the landscape we drive through all the time. If certainly in southern Idaho, we're driving on I-84, I-86, and it's left and right out the car window for as long as you can drive. And okay, so I personally love hiking through it. I think it's beautiful, as I mentioned before. I think it smells great after a rain. There are other folks who probably, maybe who are not from this area, who see it and see it as this bleak expanse where nothing is growing and nothing is being used, and have almost a negative viewpoint of it. And I'm sure this is something that you have heard before.
100%. Absolutely. And unfortunately, due to the way that weeds and wildfire and time and development have occurred, much of the landscapes that you might drive through are often among our most degraded. And so that's often in people's minds, like picturing end of July, driving down the highway, it's hot, or it just recently burned, there's smoke in the air. Yeah, like those are real, those are aspects of the biome, but I would rather have people imagine the foothills leading up adjacent to the Salmon River, rolling with sagebrush in June, ripe with blossoms of lupin and various asters, just a whole color, coordinated color show everywhere you look, a verdant green stream and meadow flowing down the middle. And as you climb, it subtly changes, but keeps its overall character until you're up on this basically alpine ridge with tiny little sagebrush and much smaller wildflowers looking out over, yeah, an expanse that carries on over the border, down into Utah, into northwest Colorado. Again, huge and endless and vast. That's the sagebrush that we're trying to get people to evoke, the part that's still connected, diverse, and resilient, and recognize that, yeah, other parts of it need our help, and no small portion of this biome has seen so much change that we really need to be thinking about how we manage it for people and nature differently, a different future than the history that we once had there.
So let's move into the Sagebrush Sea program, kind of talk about why the sagebrush step is important and what this program is really focused on and working towards.
You bet. I mean, part of it is sheer scale. Again, for the Western United States, this is a defining landscape. And for the Sagebrush Sea program, we envelop even a larger geography than we would say just is pure sagebrush step, clear out to the Northern Great Plains and Montana, down onto the Colorado Plateau and the Four Corners region, and then including like the Great Basin, Snake River Plain, Columbia Plateau in our neck of the woods over here. So its scale is a big part of the story, but in that scale, we get so much of what is the connective tissue and really the birthing ground of lots of things we cherish in the West. The headwaters of many of our magnificent rivers, the Colorado, the Columbia, pull much of their water from sagebrush steppe landscapes. So the water that sustains our salmon and our farms comes from much of the sagebrush sea. The great migration corridors of the West for pronghorn and elk and mule deer wholly depend on wintering range, especially in the sagebrush sea. Think of the great migrations up through Wyoming. And then because of its scale, it's the background, it's the home, it's the aquifer for, you know, millions of people. Reno, Boise, Salt Lake City, these are major metropolises with people trying to have a good future. If they don't have a resilient sagebrush sea, one that hopefully doesn't burn every August, one that doesn't become a dust storm due to drought every March, they can have a better future if we care for it together. So it matters on a lot of scales, scenic, wildlife, and then also just sustaining people into the future.
Well, okay, so you've outlined, I guess, really a challenge, right? It's enormous. It covers a lot of jurisdictions. There's a lot of stakeholders. There's urban development in all of these areas. And then you have the natural system that has changed certainly over the last couple hundred years. And that seems, I could imagine that seems overwhelming. Like that's, what a big task, right? So tell us about the scale and how do you target certain aspects of it so that you can gain purchase in making a difference here?
Oh, I mean, that's such a great question, and it's so essential to everything that we do. I mean, as much as this system is home to these great vistas I shared, it's also where we get a lot of our energy from, solar, wind, oil, and gas. It's where we move energy through transmission lines. The Snake River Plain was once a large and connected sagebrush system that now grows food for the country. So it has many uses beyond just its scenic wildlife, wilderness, or natural value. And so much of what we do at the Nature Conservancy is we are striking balances that get us the best possible future. So our program and our team specifically focuses on kind of how do we keep the last large and intact landscapes just so. In Idaho, think the Owyhee Highlands in southwest Idaho or the Upper Bear River Valley in southeast Idaho, and then especially the valleys of the Salmon and Snake and those beautiful, you know, fingers that run up toward the Montana border. Those landscapes still have enormous potential to sustain wildlife populations, natural plant communities, healthy water, healthy air, and we want to keep them that way. In the process, we want to find compromises for where development, energy, agriculture, grazing, these other uses of our, frankly, public lands can take place in the best possible combination for where the landscape is today and where it's probably going tomorrow with the climate pressures. And like the whole time, we're trying to do it in service of like the people who actually live and work here. So that is in pursuit of and support of indigenous-led conservation and tribal sovereignty for the tribes and indigenous communities that view these lands, have these lands as their ancestral homes, of the rural communities that earn all of their income off of access to these resources, forage and water, And then, yeah, for the cities that are where most people live and don't often think about how the air and water that they breathe and drink has everything to do with, is their environment healthy and functioning?
So what do you see as some of your biggest challenges with this program? And I'm kind of looking at how the Nature Conservancy works as well, because you work with public land, private land. You guys also purchase land that moves into your programming. You're out there, and we will find out just exactly how big the sagebrush sea is at the end of the show. You're not talking about just a small area in Idaho or
Definitely
Oregon.
Definitely not. Everything I just said is the essential challenge and the opportunity. I mean, the Nature Conservancy is one organization just by its mission and way of doing business. We work with everyone when we're trying to make compromises that work for the maximum good. Other players and entities out in the system, they do their part, either being watchdogs and litigious entities over bad outcomes or being those who drive development and improvements of landscapes. It takes everyone. Our job is to try to strike that balance I just described. And for me, I think the biggest part of that that's tricky is 7 different states, 7 different governors, 7 different funding sources, 7 different realities of what these pressures are or need to be in the future. You know, Oregon doesn't have an oil and gas industry. Wyoming does. Nevada has some of the largest gold mines in the country. Montana doesn't. You know, these are different challenges and pressures into how these lands can be used to support, again, people and nature. And our balance is to try to be both local, respond to the communities of Salmon and Chalice, Dillon, Montana, Burns, Oregon, for example, while also being kind of at this highest level of how does the Bureau of Land Management set up its regulatory processes so that things are fair, open to all, protecting the last large landscapes? How do we make sure that governors and legislatures know that it takes money to restore these landscapes? We have to invest. That money comes from somewhere. How do we create those systems to move resources to these rural communities to fight cheap grass, manage drought, fix streams, which is the core work that we do on the ground? And it's going to be a little different in every state, politics, unique ecological attributes, et cetera, but constantly bringing us back to, ooh, there is a better together here. There's a through line that works for all of us, which is a balance of uses, a North Star on the most resilient landscapes staying intact, and making sure that we follow the will of people, because they're ultimately the ones who will do the work necessary to make it all happen or not.
So as program director, do you spend more of your time boots on the ground in the sagebrush sea, or are you out there traveling, talking to all of these entities and individuals, encouraging them to be part of this program?
Oh yeah, this guy's the latter. I get the honor and the duty to go talk up a good story on the internet and in person. But it's easy and fun because I have, there's over 60 colleagues across the West who do the restoration, management, protection work that is our program. There's an orbit out of all the partners they work with, which is hundreds more people. And they're the ones generating the good stories, the great photo ops, the really successful stories of partnership. My job is just to, yeah, tell that story in the right place to the right donor or politician or agency rep. Anyone who wants to listen is willing to hear how we're trying to do business and is looking for some help that we can try to figure out how we can be a useful partner in fulfilling.
A lot of, I would imagine, there's an incredible overlap between the sagebrush sea and the outlines of that ecosystem and public lands.
Oof.
Right? Like an incredible overlap. Not everywhere, but a lot. Does it facilitate your work or the idea of restoration or maintenance of these landscapes when you're working with public, you know, land that's held in public trust? And this idea that it's not somebody's, it's all of our legacy.
Oh, so much so. Yeah. And I mean, you could easily say that our work here is a public lands program. I mean, what we are about is trying to have those successes on public lands. Most of our landscapes are dominated by either the Bureau of Land Management or the U.S. Forest Service or both. And the way in which those agencies are staffed, resourced, allowed to do or not do permitting, siting, environmental review, monitoring, makes night and day. a difference between success and failure. So we're big advocates for strong, resilient, supported land management agencies. We work with members of those offices all across the West and in DC at headquarters. It's also important to state that like public lands are multitudes. Yes, they are lands that belong to all of us. And it's also true that some people live in them much more closely than others and have an argument to say that they feel it more deeply. And we need to like recognize and understand that and try to work with it. And then, of course, all of our public lands were once and are still the homelands of tribes, tribal communities, and other indigenous peoples for much longer than there was the United States. And we are very much trying to be a better partner in seeing where co-management of our public lands and tribal sovereignty can be supported. Consultation with the agencies is a legal requirement that needs much more support. Balancing all of those viewpoints, values, identities on public lands is just as fraught as private lands. And so, the challenges shift perhaps because we have a federal partner who can make decisions, but with some things getting easier, many other things get trickier.
So I've got a question for you, and this is a personal question, your opinion. Say I'm going to go out through the sagebrush and see for the first time ever.
Yes.
Tell me what I should be looking for so I can appreciate the sagebrush like you appreciate it.
Let me answer it this way. If I was going to paint you or prescribe you the best day in the sagebrush sea, it would be something like you're up before dawn. There's no way that you're not. You drive that 30 minutes down the highway and the lights of whatever community you live in, like bend here, fade into the distance. It's a dark sky. It's a bright starry night. And just as dawn cracks, you are lucky enough or well-informed enough to be looking over a lek of 50 sage grouse strutting their best, end of April, air flat, air sacs going crazy, making weird gobbledygook noises as they perform their mating ritual. Enjoying that for an hour, you start off on your hike. Sage grouse have gone off to do their daily eating. And as you're heading through just a wall of lupin and balsam root, purple and gold, heading up a hill, you also, because you're well-informed, intersect just like the perfect point of pronghorn moving towards their summer grounds up in the nearby mountains. And it's just lines of like 50 or 100 of those weird and fantastic beasts working their way through the landscape, not minding you too much, running when they have to, but otherwise just kind of doing their deal. And then up this craggy mountain you go, full of strange volcanic rocks, because much of our sagebrush sea is on the back of volcanoes and tufts and lava flows and strange rock formations like that. Again, you get up to a ridge, it's the middle of the day, and you're looking out towards, I don't know how all these things fit together, but we're pretending right now. the country's largest saltwater lake, the Great Salt Lake. They're just shining out in front of you, carrying off into the distance. And everywhere around you, if you kind of ignore Salt Lake City, but you don't have to, is just a wild, open, magical landscape. And because you timed it well, it's not too hot because you're up at elevation. You might want to hang there before you go back for a beer at your car because it can get scorching down below. But that kind of wildlife scale, color, and unexpected mystery, oof, that's a perfect day covering some sagebrush sea.
I like it. I like it. I want to go out there. So what can people do to help in the task, a shared task, really, of preserving this ecosystem?
Yeah, you know, it's all about showing up and it's all about compromise. These are huge landscapes, but everything is going to be decided at local levels. I mean, huge landscape doesn't mean a ton of people. In some of these communities, the same Joe or Jane does like 10 jobs, is rancher, is NRCS, is county commissioner or county arm, does the work themselves. I mean, being in community and figuring out how to work with people is so essential because everything here is coming down to compromise. We need development and energy for the future that we're heading towards. We need large and intact landscapes for clean air, clean water, and resilient wildlife. We have to balance both. The states are laboratories of experimentation, and they have different ways of doing things. We need to work within those realities and fulfill what's possible in a state as populous as Colorado or one as sparsely populated as Montana. And then, you know, we're seeking a vision that unites people, not divides them. And that's, I guess, my appeal to folks. That would be the biggest one. We've got to find a place where everyone sees a future that they're included in, because we have a good track record now of seeing what conflict does for us. And it just stalls, stalls, stalls. And the biggest reality that we try to share at the Nature Conservancy is non-action. It's a choice. It's an action. It's an action that allows weeds to continue, wildfire to continue, drought to continue. Actively restoring, managing, pushing back against those forces, it takes work, it takes people and investment. And so until we can get to a point where we can cooperatively, collaboratively rise to those challenges, they will continue to erode our shared resources. So showing up, finding compromise and shared understanding and getting to work to restore what you can, that would be my biggest appeal of what we can all do here in this landscape and probably every landscape in the West.
Yeah, I'm thinking we're covering 7 states. And on a conservation end, especially if you're looking at animals, you're building, you know, animal corridors. How do we connect these sections of the sagebrush together so these animals have these corridors to move? We should start looking at conservation corridors. How are we going to connect Wyoming
so much so
to Idaho, to Oregon, then down to Nevada, back to Utah? You know, so we've got these corridors of all these different entities that we need to figure out how we can connect each of these entities.
You know, I love that vision. If you look at the map of the most resilient landscapes left in the biome, they form this beautiful, just kind of string of pearls, I call it, just as you just say, the mountains of Oregon to the mountains of Nevada, curling up to the Snake River Plain, the Upper Salmon, Upper Snake, the High Divide of Montana, and then just like out toward the Northern Great Plains. And yeah, we should be working to keep that vibrant, connected, just the string of beautiful nature that really unites the entire West.
I love that vision, and I love that it also connects us to our trivia question.
Oh,
yes, it allows you to tell us in acres, how big is the sagebrush sea?
Right. So short answer, the one that I know to give is 175 million acres, which the AI robots tell me is like the size of Turkey. You know, fact check me if you will, but pretty large. Lots of caveats, actually probably half of what we once had prior to development and disturbance. And always depends on where you draw the boundary, because it, again, I said, bleeds in the Colorado Plateau, the Northern Great Plains, other biomes. But if you had to pin me down, let's call it about 175 million acres.
There we go.
That's a big place.
That is the sagebrush sea. So awesome. Thank you, Matt, for joining us today. And I encourage everyone who lives in the sagebrush sea to go see the project. Just go to nature.org/sagebrushsea and really find out what Matt and his crew are working towards. Again, thank you, Matt.
My pleasure. This was super fun. Thanks so much.
The Nature of Idaho receives support from listener contributions to KISU. Shows are produced at the KISU studios in Pocatello at Idaho State University with editing and production by Mackenzie Young. Music is by Idaho's very own Sons of Bannock. Audio of all past episodes can be found at kisu.org and select podcast services. Send your thoughts and suggestions to noidkisu@isu.edu.